According to the American Association of Neurological Surgeons, between 4 and 20% of college and high school football players sustain a brain injury at least once during a single season. The National Football League has acknowledged that a condition, which is now called chronic traumatic encephalopathy, has developed in many former NFL players. Symptoms, memory loss, cognitive impairment, headaches, depression, and even suicide has been reported. Current evidence suggests that repeated hits to the head can cause permanent brain damage. Hard hits to the head that cause a temporary loss of consciousness are called concussions. Hello, I'm Dr. Randy Brewer, and welcome to Health Matters on Red River Radio. Tonight's topic, concussions in sports. Joining us tonight from the LSU School of Medicine here in Shreveport, Dr. Anil Nanda, Chairman and Professor of the Department of Neurosurgery, Dr. Christina Notoriani, Assistant Professor and Chief of Pediatric Neurosurgery, and Dr. Shane Barton, Assistant Professor of Orthopedic Surgery. Dr. Barton is also the Medical Director of the Willis Knighton Sports Medicine Program. He's a member of the Weightlifting Subcommittee of the United States Olympic Sports Medicine Committee. He's a former clinical instructor at Harvard Medical School, team physician for the New England Patriots, and currently a team physician for a number of local high school, colleges, and athletic departments. Dr. Nanda, thank you so much for joining us with Health Matters. You know, a lot of times we hear neurologists and neurosurgeons use the term traumatic brain injury. Would you consider a concussion a traumatic brain injury?
Yeah, it is a kind of a brain injury. You know, it tends to be mild, so we don't get all excited about it, but it's gotten a lot of press recently, and it's important. You know, traditionally in the media, or, you know, you say you had a car accident, somebody's in a coma, that gets a lot more attention because it's serious. But a concussion has no real visible signs. You know, they have a loss of consciousness, so they just have a zinger, and they come back. So people say, well, it's not that important or it's not that relevant. And I think the last few years, the research has shown it's a serious public health issue in sports and colleges. So I think it's important to sort of focus a Klieg light on this and talk about it and create community awareness.
Yeah, I think community awareness is certainly an issue that is very important as we bring sports into the communities. Younger and younger people are going into sports at younger ages. Contact sports are very popular, from soccer leagues to baseball leagues and even little league football. Dr. Notoriani, welcome to Health Matters. We really appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
You know, when a child or an adolescent suffers brain trauma, it's obviously a very traumatic event for the child and the family. How do you determine how much brain is damaged, and how do you determine how well the recovery is going to go?
Well, I think current literature, there's really no way to determine exactly how much of the brain is actually injured. Imaging studies are not often done on these children, and if they are done, they're usually normal. So what we're seeing right now in the literature that's coming out is things that are linked to a longer recovery, or how much they may or may not recover, is linked to the number of concussions that children are having within a certain time frame. Usually older children seem to have a harder time recovering than younger children, and they don't know that's because of the plasticity of the brain itself. Prolonged symptoms seem to be linked to a longer recovery and maybe not full recovery. But overall, we just don't know how much a child is going to recover. Most children recover completely and have no long-term side effects. However, with repeated injury, we do get worried that perhaps they will have some long-term damage from that.
Yeah, long-term damage from repeated injuries. I think we're going to talk about that quite a bit more later. We always welcome and invite your questions. Please call us at 1-800-552-8502. We have a question from the internet. As an umpire, I have taken several hits with a baseball over the past 20 years. On at least one occasion, I was diagnosed with a slight concussion. Will I be more susceptible to a concussion in the future? Dr. Barton, welcome to Health Matters on Red River Radio.
Thank you. Over your
years as a practicing sports medicine physician and team physician, do you see concussions being more prevalent?
I don't know if they're more prevalent. I think the biggest change has been the, as Dr. Nanda said, the awareness that the community has of the potential long-term effects. You know, being dazed or having a zinger, as he said, or being a little foggy, that was just kind of considered to be part of many sports, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago. And now we're seeing that what we thought before was a fairly benign injury that was temporary in its extent can have long-term consequences, particularly for the younger athletes, these adolescents. And so I think the awareness, I mean, certainly the awareness over the past 5 to 10 years has increased tremendously for the better to bring this kind of to the public's knowledge.
So in terms of the umpire, he was hit with a bat, had a slight concussion. Will he be susceptible to another concussion in the future any more than he was during his first episode of a concussion? Or is he back to a baseline risk level at this point?
Well, I mean, that depends on a couple of things. But in general, you would say if there's been a long time interval between his initial injury, that his he eventually returned back to a baseline risk, particularly being an older, an adult. If he's struck with a ball within the first, a lot of times we like to say between the first 7 and 10 days out, you're at a really increased risk. That data really pertains more to adolescents. We don't know in the adult how quickly they can recover. Again, as we've already mentioned, the plasticity of the brain in the adult is a lot less, its ability to recover from insult. And it really depends on the grade of his the impacts that he's had. But, if it's been a year since he gets hit in the head once a year, gets dazed, I think his risk really is probably going to remain baseline.
Sounds very good. Now let's hear an interview from former NFL quarterback and Shreveport native Stan Humphries.
We have with us Stan Humphries, Shreveport native. He played at University of Louisiana Monroe in college. Back then it was known as Northeast Louisiana University. Led the Indians to a Division II championship in 1987. Was then drafted by the Washington Redskins, played backup there for a couple of years, and then went to start with the San Diego Chargers, where he played in the Super Bowl 1994-95 season. Stan, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So we've been talking a little bit about concussions, and I understand you experienced concussions during your career. What was that like for you?
Well, I had basically 10 concussions throughout my NFL career. Nowadays, it's a lot more talked about than it used to be talked about, so I'm sure I had a few through college and high school and all that, but back then it was kind of, everybody talked about you got your bell rung. It wasn't so much concussions and all that, so through the NFL, though, having all that I had and learning more about it as I went through it. After about 10 years and my last one that I had in Cincinnati in 1998, I just felt like it was time for me to retire and get out and let somebody else have fun. But, I don't think it hampered me in any way as far as my career. Hopefully that now that my career is over with through the rest of my life, it won't be as bad either, but you never know.
Yeah, I know that's been a concern with many NFL players coming out and saying that past concussions have affected them.
Well, I mean, I have headaches every day. I mean, there's no doubt about that. I do have that more than usual, and I'm sure some of that is from that. But so far I feel good. My wife tells me I still have mood swings, so maybe that has something to do with it, but maybe I can blame that on that. But anyway, I think we just have to keep doing research on it and learn. And I think we have to be careful of every time an athlete does something or something happens that we go right there and blame it on that. We have to keep doing research and find out.
As you went into more advanced levels of play through college and the NFL, did you see that bigger, stronger, faster players ended up having more severe concussions or maybe more frequent concussions?
Well, I think what's happened over the time is that throughout the last 25 years, 30 years, athletes have become so much faster, stronger, bigger because of it went from football being a 4-month sport, 5-month sport, to a 12-month sport. And because of that, athletes were able to get faster, bigger, stronger. So the collisions were a lot more extensive. And I think that's the cause for a lot of it, is because of the speed, the strength into the contacts now that are causing a lot more of the concussions than maybe in the past some.
Balancing with that, we have more advanced helmets, we have foam and different liquid padding, as well as more rules against using the helmet as a weapon, but we're still seeing a lot of concussions.
Yeah, I think that technology as far as the helmets has become to where at one point there for a while, and they're trying to get away from it now, there for a while they were using the helmets as a weapon. You know, I always used to talk about you almost could play football without a helmet, and maybe they would take their head out of the tackling situation and you wouldn't have as many concussions. You know, technology and everything, they're going to continue to try to get better. They're going to continue to change some rules, from teaching people to lead with their helmet, you know. And, you know, that goes back to, you know, little league, little kids playing the game. You know, a lot of little kids are having concussions. Well, it goes back to teaching them the right way, fitting their helmet properly. I can remember back when I was playing third, fourth, fifth grade. I mean, you'd see kids coming out there and their helmet was five times too big. Well, I mean, it's not a good helmet, and or it might be a instead of a proper helmet, it might be like a old New Orleans Saints souvenir helmet they put it on to go to practice with, and that's not going to protect them.
Yeah, I think I was proud to wear my brother's high school helmet when I was, you know, practicing right. in elementary school. So I was probably wearing a ninth grader's helmet when I was in the sixth grade.
Right, and it wasn't fitted properly, right. and it wasn't going to protect you. And we've got to have coaches that are not just people that are out there because my kid's playing, so I'm going to be out there. We got to have people that, and there's nothing wrong with parents being out there. They need to be properly taught the correct way to help our kids go forward.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Do you remember your parents or your coaches ever giving you instructions about not avoiding concussions? And obviously you played offense, but right. Defensive players as well.
Not so much avoiding them, but just teaching you how to tackle. Teaching you to tackle with your shoulder and, you know, with your head up and, you know, not also just saving from concussion, but saving from other injuries, neck injuries, things like that.
How many times would you say that you had your bell rung as sort of a non-concussive event where you stayed in the game?
I mean, that probably happened probably once every game that you get hit hard or whatever. And, kind of knocks you for a loop for a second, and then you just kind of you get right back into it. I used to always laugh because in the NFL, 98% of your games were on Sunday. Well, whenever we'd get a concussion, the first thing the doctor would say to you is, "Hey, what day is it?" We'd be like, "It's Sunday." I mean, you know, I mean, let's be real. Ask another question, you know. But anyway, you learn. Especially at that level, you learn how to, I guess you could just say, manipulate the system to get back on the field.
Well, you mentioned if you get off the field, then you're basically walking away from a job
right.
at that level.
Yeah, you know, the NFL, the average player lasts 3 years. You know, they used to give us a base test for concussions. We would take a test at the beginning of the year before season started. So once you had a concussion, you would come back the next day and you would take the test again. Well, because that is your livelihood, that is your job, somebody is trying to take your job from you, guys started getting to where they took that base test before the season and they would do bad on it on purpose.
You know, it seems like it could be a little bit unlike a physical injury. You know, you dislocate a shoulder and you're out for maybe the rest of the season.
Right.
You rehab after the season, maybe you come back the next season.
Right.
We have a concussion, you may be better in a week. So the perception may be that concussions are not a big deal.
Right.
So they may not feel like they're sacrificing their brain.
You
know,
really,
they're sacrificing
really never
their bodies.
Know because, you know, I've had them before to where the next day you have headaches. When you go to jog or something, you start to get dizzy. You never know the next day what's going to happen. That could last for a week. It could last for 2 weeks, 3 weeks. You don't know.
Let's go back to the kids for a moment. Do you think that we should do anything with kids? Let's say a concussion occurs in fifth or sixth grade and another one occurs in seventh or eighth grade. Are there a number of concussions that we may say, you know, the kid's talent level may not be there? Should he play another sport?
Probably 15, 20 years ago, I would have said that after his second or third, you know, who knows? I think now they're becoming more updated, better research, that they could answer that question. I can't answer that question, but I think you have to seriously look at it harder now 15, 20 years ago, you have two, okay, we have three, okay, just keep going, you know. But now I think parents are more apt to look at it harder. I think doctors are more apt to look at it harder, that you're at this age, you've already had this, two of them already, we need to really seriously watch this, especially at that age.
Well, we have so many underprivileged kids who see football as, you know, a great opportunity to utilize their talent, make a good living, and may not have the resources in terms of coaches and parents and doctors available to them. Whose responsibility is it to take, you know, take responsibility for protecting these kids?
It's the parents. It's definitely the parents. The parents have to look at it as this is my child, not as this is my opportunity to have my child play at the college level, at the pro level, and the stuff that I can get out of it. It's more of, this is my child. I have to take care of, I have to make the decision for my child that I feel like that is the best at this time until my child can make the decisions on their own.
All right, Stan, we really appreciate you being here today. Looking back, if you had to do it all over again, would you still have taken that same pathway in your career?
I would definitely do it again, and I enjoyed my time. And, you know, it's just like anything else. I mean, injuries are a part of that sport, and you just have to realize that when you go into it.
What would you tell the kid who's got talent, eighth or ninth grade, they want to play in the NFL? What sort of advice would you give them?
Well, I go around talking to kids all the time, and I basically, especially when I was playing, I talked to a lot of groups in high schools and junior highs. And I told kids all the time, I said, play every sport you can play. I think what happens nowadays, too many kids try to, I'm going to be baseball. I'm just going to play baseball. And then they play baseball all year round. They play on the travel teams. They play on this team. And play everything, you know, because it's one of those situations to where they think they're going to try to get ready for the major leagues or for the NFL or something like that. And they don't realize that less than 1% make that.
Well, Stan, we really appreciate you coming and being on Red River Radio today, and we wish you best of luck, and thank you so much.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
That was Stan Humphries, Shreveport, Louisiana native. Went to the Super Bowl with the 1994-95 San Diego Chargers. Stan retired in 1998 after he suffered 10 concussions while in the NFL. Dr. Nanda, what did you think of the interview? What's your take on it?
Well, I think it's very educational. You know, he's somber about it. He's realistic. He's not in denial. And yet he has a zest for life. You know, you ask him, you're going to do this all over again? He said he would. And, I mean, you have to admire that in whatever you do. But there is a tone of caution there because a lot of NFL players, as they get older in their 40s and 50s, are finding this. I mean, I think the tragic thing 2 years ago was a University of Pennsylvania football player at 21 shot himself, and he had signs of concussive changes at 21. So this is a long, drawn-out thing, and to minimize the public health and to glamorize sort of this gladiator approach to sports, it just, you have to be a little cautious. I mean, people need to know the risk. I mean, it's no fun having dementia at 50 and killing yourself. You know, this is a huge public health issue that we cannot belittle and say, oh, no, it's glamorous. I mean, I think he was very honest about it. He loved it. But I do think you can be more careful. And, you know, I don't think you need to sort of say, oh, just carry on. It'll be fine. And I think that's the biggest danger for the viewers out there. If your son broke his arm, you would never tell him to play football or soccer. Or if he broke his ankle, you would not. But you get a concussion, it's like, well, nothing wrong. Go back. You know, you're being a wimp or something. So I think that's the cautionary tale there.
I believe there was an abundance of caution. And please call us with your questions. We invite your inquiries. Our number here is 1-800-552-8502. This is Health Matters on Red River Radio. With us tonight, we have Dr. Anil Nanda, Chairman and Professor of Neurosurgery at LSU, Dr. Christina Notoriani, Chief of Pediatric Neurosurgery at LSU, and Dr. Shane Barton, Team Physician for a number of local universities and athletic departments. Again, the number is 1-800-552-8502. Dr. Notoriani, Stan mentioned something along the lines of the parents taking the burden of the responsibility for protecting the the children. And I know you work with a number of underage children or underprivileged children. What's your take on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I do think it's always a parent's responsibility to watch out and protect their children. But I think as children get older and you're looking at adolescence, it's not just the parents. It's educating the coaches and the players themselves and teaching them what concussion is. And part of that is maybe moving away from calling it concussion and calling it what it is, which is mild traumatic brain injury. And I think people kind of get away from that and they say, oh, you just had your bell rung and get back in there. And in reality, they've actually had a real injury. And so educating children from the, you know, lower levels up, high school levels, collegial levels, and teaching them that this is an actual injury. And, you know, the CDC has come out with some guidelines on how to tell children about it, how to tell coaches about traumatic brain injury, how to tell parents and everyone to teach them the signs and symptoms and what needs to be done. And going with the motto that it's better to sit out one game than sit out the entire season. And, you know, it's not so bad if you have to sit out one game. If you do, you know, have an injury, have a brain injury, you do get knocked out or even not knocked out, but just feel dizzy, feel uncomfortable, sit out, get examined, get checked out. And in the long run, it's probably safer for you and better for you. And so it's not just the parents. I think educating the players themselves is a huge responsibility. And the players need to take control and protect themselves, just like they're wearing the protective equipment out there.
And absolutely, as we're in an educational environment where resources are quite scarce and we're putting these at-risk brains out there, you know, it's a daunting task I think we all have to protect these children because, like you said, they want to get out there and they want to play the game. And many of them, you know, may have pride in the fact that they can get up and can go back in the game. Dr. Barton, I know you were instrumental in developing the Louisiana Youth Concussion Act with the state. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, yeah, I mean, really, Dr. Nanda, I think, played one of the largest roles and actually testified in front of the congressional body. I was involved on the side through the Louisiana Orthopedic Association and through some of our the Louisiana High School Athletic Association and trying to better come up with a way to define what a concussion was, what are the guidelines that we can put into place with scientific evidence that we can instruct coaches and players about you know, the best way to react when someone is injured, what those signs of injury are, and to really to kind of help give athletic trainers, team physicians, concerned parents more information about when kids could and could not go back in, you know, into a potential situation where another impact could occur. Really, what this boils down to is, you know, the first thing is return to play. You know, when can a kid that has a concussion return to play? Everyone that's over 30 years old that was involved in high school sports knows someone that got their bell rung and probably had it happen to yourself. You set out a few minutes, you shook it off, still a little dizzy, cobwebs or whatever, but you went back in. We know now that is extremely dangerous. And with the new research that's come out looking at long-term sequela or outcomes from these injuries, especially repeated injuries in the adolescent, we know that there is absolutely no reason with any type of concussion to go back in the same day.
Thank you very much. We have a caller, Chris from Natchitoches. Chris, what's your question?
Yeah, Dr. Notoriani, I have twin boys with spina bifida, myelomeningocele, and they have hydrocephalus as well, and both of them have a VP shunt. And my question is, are the effects of hydrocephalus, of pressure around the brain, is that similar to a concussion, or is a concussion only from a sudden impact?
No, that is not the same thing. You know, hydrocephalus is a treatable condition with a buildup of spinal fluid in the brain. When the child has a shunt, the spinal fluid is effectively being drained off, and so that pressure is relieved. The studies that have come out with concussion are from forceful impacts on the brain, so forceful, repeated head injuries resulting in an altered level of consciousness, whether or not you black out completely. But that is not exactly the same thing that you're looking at in your children with hydrocephalus.
Thank you.
Dr. Barton, you mentioned that going back into play after you have your bell rung or maybe a mild concussive event is not a good idea. And I think the American Academy of Neurology recommends that the first 10 days after a concussion tends to be the period of greatest risk for being diagnosed with another concussion. What should coaches look for when they're trying to decide whether a player should go back? Should they see a physician? I believe the Louisiana Act recommends that a licensed healthcare provider actually evaluate the player before they go back to play.
Yeah, there really are four things that the Louisiana High School Athletic Association recommends. It's what they call their basic concussion rule, and this comes from some of the legislation that Dr. Nanda helped put through. Number one, no athlete should return to play the same day. And that does not mean with loss of consciousness only. That means even with a mild concussion. Someone takes a shot to the head, they have a headache, they have altered vision for a short period of time, nausea, a little bit of short-term confusion. Maybe they're not aware of the game situation. Maybe a better question than what day is it for a pro athlete can pull those little subtle things out. Even someone that's having difficulty concentrating in the classroom, you know, those are continued signs of a concussion, so no one should return to play same day. Number two, they should be evaluated by an appropriate healthcare professional that day, okay? If they have a concussion, that may be an athletic trainer for something that's very mild. That may be a neurosurgeon for someone who has a significant closed head injury. Number three, an athlete diagnosed with a concussion really should be medically cleared. And in the state of Louisiana, it's either by an MD or a DO, a doctor of osteopathic medicine or a medical doctor. But that clearance only gives them the ability to then begin the return to play. And that ultimately should fall on the head of the medical director of sports medicine for that team or the athletic trainer or the coaches. And hopefully if the parents are educated, the parents will play a big role in that as well.
Please call us at 1-800-552-8502 to join our discussion about sports concussions. You mentioned the resources that are required to get an athlete back to play after a concussion. But what about the kids? The kids in underprivileged areas, they may not have access to a team physician. Their parents may not have been educated about what a concussion is. The coaches are, you know, very often volunteers. And I believe the Youth Concussion Act recommends that coaches, players, as well as parents undergo concussion training or some sort of awareness educational program before the season. I guess the real question is that happening? And since the Concussion Act came into place, do we have any data to see if it's working or not?
So I don't know of any formal data to show in Louisiana whether there's been substantial improvement yet. But, yes, there are things happening. I can really speak towards our local community here. Our athletic trainers are well-trained. We have a concussion, essentially, seminar with each of these trainers as they come in going over these injuries and the management. But if you look at the kids you're talking about, you can't go to each one of these kids and teach them and teach the parents. You don't have access to them as a healthcare provider. But what you can do is say, we're trusting the health of these kids to these coaches. If you're going to take the job, even as a voluntary coach, you're going to be held responsible for providing a basic level of healthcare. And to support those coaches who are giving their time and volunteering and doing these things, we as a medical community have to make available to them training. And there is training available free of charge. Louisiana Health, High School Athletic Association online, there's seminars. It's in everyday language. It's easy to understand. They're not asking you to be a doctor, but they're giving you ideas of how to recognize a concussion and what the next step should be.
Mm-hmm. We have another caller, Herschel from Shreveport. Herschel, what's your call?
Well, my question is, are there people who seem to be more susceptible to concussions that result in early dementia? And also, is it apparent that those people who play football for a longer period of time, particularly professional players, are more likely to have some problem rather than just a high school or college player whose career is over in 8 years versus a professional whose career is over in 18 years.
Dr. Nanda, I understand there's some proteins in the brain that may be associated with this, you know, syndrome of dementia after concussions. Is there any way of testing for that before someone gets into athletics?
I think that's the cost will be prohibitive. There's a tau protein that you can check. But I think the issue really is, yes, a professional athlete has more concussions because he's in the game longer. But I think for a younger person who plays college football, I think if you're careful, I think the key point is it's additive. If you have a concussion and you get another one, it's not 2 plus 2 is 4, 2 plus 2 is 20 then. And that's sort of the number that people need to realize, that you're really vulnerable, especially the younger brain. You're going to get hit. You get, and that's what happened with like the Zach Lystad law in Seattle. Zach Lystad had a concussion and he went back into the game, and then he had a bad concussion and he was, you know, he was vegetative for a couple of months. So that danger cannot be overemphasized. And I echo Dr. Barton's point that, I mean, it's a very simple thing, and the ripple effect of these concussion laws is enormous. In Washington State, the soccer coaches were like, you know, my daughter had a concussion and I couldn't have diagnosed this before, but because the law came in, I read about it, I can diagnose it. You know, you, no pun intended, you don't need a rocket scientist to diagnose a concussion. It's very simple. Anybody can do it. And I think that awareness has to be there, that index of suspicion that something isn't right, that we need to create that community awareness.
Yeah. You know, along the lines, scientifically, a number of funds have been allocated towards the study of concussion now through the NIH and through, actually, the NFL has allocated some money. But interestingly enough, if you look at the research that they're doing, they're looking at brains from retired NFL players and they're looking at imaging. But in terms of what causes this accumulative effect of tau protein or what causes these changes in the brain to start, we're really looking at the tip of the iceberg. Dr. Notoriani, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, the research is significantly lacking right now. I think we have an idea of a tau protein. It's linked to Alzheimer's disease. And so the question is this the exact same protein and what's going on? And the problem is that, you know, imaging is not usually done with concussion. And if you do concussion, do imaging, a lot of times that imaging is negative. And so we have to think of more sophisticated ways to try to diagnose this problem earlier. And it's just, it's a hard thing to put your finger on. And I think, you know, the research is coming, but right now we just don't know. And so there's really an air of caution out there. And I think that's where, as a medical community, we really take that air of caution and say, hey, you know, let's take a step back and let's be careful here, because we're trying to protect the children. We're trying to protect young adults and older adults as well.
You know, about 12 kids in high school and college playing football will die every year in this country. And about a third of those are from head injuries. Many of the other injuries are maybe previously unknown congenital heart defects, also overheating and things along those lines. But let's say, for example, what should a coach or a parent look for if something like an epidural hematoma or a subdural hematoma is developing and they think that might be a concussion?
Typically, if you've sustained a blow where you are going to have a epidural or a subdural hematoma that's going to need an emergent evacuation, a majority of the time the child will have some loss of consciousness either immediately or shortly after their injury. They will be significantly confused. They will be maybe difficult to arouse. And then you may see even signs of neurologic injury such as weakness or a deficit on one side of their body, abnormal pupil size. Those would all be signs that something more serious is going on rather than just a small concussion or a mild injury.
So if the kid's not waking right back up, then 911 is probably the best thing to do at that
Absolutely.
Point. Absolutely. So the research is coming, I understand. Dr. Nanda, if we actually opened up one of the brains of one of these NFL players that had chronic traumatic encephalopathy, what would we see?
Well, you really see signs of dementia. You see these tangles and see plaque and see this tau protein that, you know, it comes from repetitive injury. And I think you have to recognize the Boston University scientists who made this a career, that she looked at something that people said, oh, you know, we're not going to find anything. So I think that was a very startling revelation. And once that happened, you hear NFL players now, they don't, you know, unfortunately, if they do commit suicide, they don't shoot themselves in the head. And the reason is they want to contribute their brain to the advancement of this disease because they have depression, they have problems. And so they're like, well, at least in my passing away, let science advance. So I think the only tangible proof we have is these things in the psychometric test that you see that says there is some impairment or there is an issue. Yeah.
Again, our number is 1-800-552-8502. We welcome your inquiries. Dr. Barton, let's talk a little bit about protection. You know, we've used the helmet since, I believe it was Harvard and Yale who petitioned President Roosevelt in the late 18th century to use helmets during the very elite game of football. So we've come a long way. Are helmets really protective against concussion?
Yes, they do provide some protection, but they are by no means going to prevent concussion. Remember that the, as Dr. Notariano said, the impact is the brain striking the skull often. It can occur from the direct blow. It can actually, if you imagine, the brain can rotate inside the skull. It can slam against the opposite side of the skull. There can be multiple impacts. Wrapping in foam the outside of the skull does not cushion the brain from the inside of the skull. And so you can prevent, you know, helmets are very good at preventing massive cranial trauma, skull fractures, lacerations, things like that. But, you know, there's been a new phenomenon of helmet wear in soccer because of heading the ball. And that's shown absolutely no decrease in the rate of concussions or mild traumatic brain injury. Same thing in bull riding. Bull riders now are required to wear helmets in these junior circuits. A lot of the professionals still don't have to. But we know that that decreases the risk of death because of cranial trauma, but not the decrease the risk of concussion. So these helmets sometimes can give a false sense of protection.
And I think you got to remember Michael Schumacher, the great F1 Formula One driver, was with his helmet skiing, and he had a massive head injury. So, you know, the helmet is great, but if you're going to fall from 10,000 feet, no helmet's going to help you. You know, it's going to be a major injury.
Yeah, I think the point of the brain basically sloshing around in the skull is what you're making, and that it's the brain hitting the skull, not necessarily the skull, you know, from the helmet contact. You know, research at Virginia Tech, they developed an accelerometer device where they can actually put this device in a helmet. And one thing that they've found out, they've tracked kids at various ages along the lines of their schedules. And players as young as 7 suffer hits to the head that are comparable in magnitude to even high school and adult players. And most of these hits that can be concussive in terms of measurements, but they don't necessarily result in a clinical concussion, are happening during practice. Dr. Barton, should we alter the way these kids practice football or other sports?
I mean, that's a question that's going to be yes, we have to alter the way that we're doing things if we want to change the outcomes of these concussions. You know, we can't continue to do the exact same thing the same way we've done. There's always going to be some risk. You cannot completely remove the risk of a concussion in these collision sports and even the non-collision sports, the traditional non-collision sports where collisions can still, of course, happen. You know, there are a lot of these NFL players that have suffered from this chronic injury who state that eventually football is going to be outlawed as a brutal sport. I don't know if that will happen, but I do know that changes will have to take place. Kind of a combination of the coaches, the players, the medical communities, especially with adolescents, the parents being involved, that will direct changes for these sports to try to make them as safe as possible.
You know, and Stan Humphries makes a good point. You know, when he was growing up, football was not a 12-month sport. And now we have summer leagues. They're playing 5-on-5. And basically, you know, they're practicing a lot, you know, to become elite players. And we know that high school football players are actually twice as likely to get a concussion during a game or a practice as a college player. And there's got to be an educational opportunity there, especially at the high school level. An interesting article was published in Neurology in December of 2013. Dr. Thomas McAllister looked at head acceleration time in football players and hockey players at Dartmouth. He measured the strengths of the blows sustained to the head, but they also looked at cognition, and they looked at brain imaging before and after a season. And the kids that had more hits did worse on testing compared to the kids who had less hits. But there weren't that many concussions, and the brain imaging didn't change. Dr. Notariani, what do you make of that?
Well, I think, you know, when you're talking about concussion, it's a chronic disease. So it's a repeated concussions that we're seeing down the line as adults. Then you're seeing more changes on MRI and on imaging in terms of white matter atrophy and disease. So, you know, it's not surprising that they didn't see a change in the MRIs. It's not surprising either that the children who got hit more have more neurocognitive problems. That's clinically how we test for return to play. It's not just have their symptoms resolved, but is their thinking and processing back to where they were at a baseline? And there's several, you know, sideline coaching tests that they can give on the sideline to kind of analyze that quickly. But also when they come to see a physician for an evaluation for return to play, these are very brief 20-minute exams that can be given on a computer, and you can easily check to see what's their speed of processing, not just how many are they getting right, but how quickly are they making that decision and how quickly are they making the determinations and analyzing the data that's coming to them.
You know, and we're sending, you know, underprivileged kids to college ostensibly to get an education, and they're in a very rigorous sport. And I think some of these issues could be addressed from the cognitive standpoint because, you know, looking at brain pathology and looking at imaging, we could be only looking for the most severe cases. Dr. Nanda, I understand that, you know, the changes in the brain that occur with, say, chronic hypertension or dementia can look a lot like changes that may happen from, say, chronic head injury, let's say dementia pugilistica. From the standpoint of concussions, would you recommend any routine scanning in, say, a professional athlete who's playing? Maybe they have zingers, as we mentioned, you know, two or three times during the season. Do you think imaging surveillance has any role to play?
I really don't think so. It's not cost-effective. It's not appropriate. There's radiation. We know now CAT scans is a lot of radiation, especially for kids. So I don't think there's any role for that. But I'd also like to make another point. You know, we keep talking football, football, football. The commonest cause for concussion in the United States is bicycling. It's the bicycles that will give you concussions, and that's a simple remedy, at least wearing a helmet. You know, things like lacrosse, hockey, all those sports have an incidence of concussion. You know, we're football crazy here, but still, you know, you have to remember that you're going down on your bicycle and you could fall, you're not wearing a helmet. You could get a big clot. You just won't get a concussion.
Yeah, and I think also you forget that because it's football, you always think that it's men who are getting concussion than boys. But, you know, female athletes are just as susceptible to getting concussions, and even sports like cheerleading and gymnastics. And so it's not just a male situation, and especially female athletes have to remember that too.
Yeah, there's one study that points out that female soccer players are much less likely to report concussion symptoms based on lack of education, and they're much more likely to continue playing after having a mild concussion sort of syndrome with heading the ball. We have a question from Ryan in Shreveport. Ryan, what's your question?
Hello. Yes, I was wondering, coming from somebody who's had many concussions, as an adult, what symptoms, signs should we look for, you know, pre-dementia or things in that area?
Dr. Notoriani, what would one look for if they're looking for signs of dementia in a history of multiple concussions?
I think it would depend on your age. If you're talking about someone who's 40 years old and having problems with short-term memory loss, remembering things that they did the day before or last week, having chronics with chronic headaches, those could all be signs that they've had some chronic damage from repeated concussion. It all depends on your age. If you're 65, 70, then that's less likely to be concussion dementia, more likely to be, you know, natural history dementia.
Absolutely. We have a question from Natchitoches. The caller wants to know if there's any chance to upgrade the design of football helmets. And that brings to mind an op-ed in the New York Times from January of 2014. Dr. Nanda, I know you read the New York Times, so let me just summarize for you, and maybe you can elaborate a little bit. So Gregory Myers, the director of research in sports medicine in Cincinnati, and he calls this brain slosh phenomenon basically too much space in our skull for our brain. We have fluid, but we don't have enough of the spongy stuff to protect the brain. So he makes the analogy to bighorn sheep and woodpeckers. And he mentions that the sheep actually have cavities in their horns, and they rebreathe CO2. And so they keep this venous dilation in the brain, basically, to provide more cushion for the brain. The woodpecker as well has these, they have muscles in their necks that contract and keep more blood in the brain. And so should we design a suit that decreases cerebral venous return, or maybe a helmet to protect our brains?
Unless you're a creationist, you know, I think it's not, de-evolution is not going to happen. So it's not like we're going to evolve into woodpeckers playing football. But I think you raise an important point, and that is in the 90s and the 80s, they compromised the integrity of these helmets. And the study you quoted from Virginia, they put less and less padding and more and more radio signal stuff. So, you know, here's they're saying Omaha, Omaha. And they're not really making sure the helmet is safe. So now I think they've gone back and said, we need a safe helmet. We don't need just a cosmetic helmet with a lot of wireless stuff in it. But I would not recommend de-evolution as a form of preventing concussions. I think that might take a couple of million years.
You know, Dr. Barton, it's often said, and Stan mentions it in his interview, you know, would no helmet or less of a helmet actually protect football players and other contact sports players more based on the sensitivity that we would obviously have in the skull if we couldn't basically place a weapon on our heads? Would that work?
Well, I think if there were one mechanism for skull injury or for concussion, for traumatic brain injury, and we could identify that, and we said the only time that ever happens is when someone uses their head as a striking force, let's just get rid of their helmets. Well, then, of course, it would get rid of that. People would, most people, if because of pain, would not use their head to lead to strike. But that's not the only place that this happens. It also occurs from unintentional impact. Someone tackling you, you're not leading with your head, but someone else may drive their shoulder into your head. Again, we're talking about football. You know, my 14-year-old is a lacrosse player, and it's amazing how they impact each other there. Of course, the helmets can help protect, but they're not leading with their head at all. And so the helmet is protecting from a different type of mechanism. So to just get rid of it would keep people from leading with their head as an injury mechanism, but it would not protect people from being struck by others.
Again, our number is 1-800-552-8502. We invite your calls. We are on Health Matters on Red River Radio. With us tonight, Dr. Anil Nanda, Professor and Chairman of Neurosurgery at LSU Health Science Center in Shreveport. Dr. Christina Notoriani, Chief of Pediatric Neurosurgery at LSU in Shreveport. And Dr. Shane Barton, Director of Willis-Knighton Sports Medicine's Program. Dr. Barton, you mentioned lacrosse and some other sports. I understand there are strict rules in hockey regarding contact, except at the pro level. And now the National Hockey League is facing lawsuits similar to the NFL. And I understand a number of these concussions are really from fighting and they're not from playing the sport. Is that true?
Well, I mean, there certainly are concussions that occur from fighting in professional hockey. You know, our professional hockey team here, I was closely involved with Coach Muscat and that group. And a number of those players growing up, especially the Canadian kids, there were so many of them that had come down here, had been playing since they could – essentially the time they could walk, and they would have a tremendous history of multiple impacts. You say, how many concussions? 20 or 30. And they're really talking about loss of consciousness. They're not just talking about concussions in general. And so, you know, when we start looking at things like lacrosse and hockey and how, you know, the interest in these sports is going up, the risk for these concussions as players become more aggressive and more serious, if we don't do things to change the way they play, the risk of those concussions is going to continue to increase.
Absolutely. Again, our number is 1-800-552-8502. Harvard neurologist Dr. Marie Pasinski said part of the problem is that brain trauma almost certainly begins years before an athlete enters the professional arena. According to the American Association of Neurological Surgeons, as we mentioned, 4 to 20% of college and high school football players sustain at least one brain injury during the course of a season. And so what we're thinking is that this chronic traumatic encephalopathy is a cumulative event that occurs over many, many years. And so as sports have become more and more competitive over time, players are practicing more and more, and damage from this sort of experience can be subclinical, and it could add up over time. And so we don't think imaging would necessarily be viable as a surveillance tool. Dr. Notarainni, are there any surveillance tools other than education that we could suggest to parents and players and coaches?
You know, I mean, I don't think that there's really anything that you can do at this time to determine if someone is at early risk or developing early signs of CTE. That's unfortunate, but perhaps down the road there will be some kind of serum marker or something that we can develop. But you know, the brain is not an easy place to get to. It's not just doing a muscle biopsy or anything like that, and so it's a hard condition to diagnose early, and the literature just isn't there yet, and so we just haven't found the right way to determine those players that are at risk or developing early subclinical signs of chronic traumatic encephalopathy.
You know, there's this syndrome that's called the second impact syndrome. Dr. Nanda, what is the second impact syndrome, and what should coaches look for with that?
Well, I think the important thing is if you've had a concussion, you are so vulnerable in that period of time after that. And that's what happened to Zach Lyston in Seattle. I mean, he was an 18-year-old. He was playing football, and he had a concussion. He didn't get out of the game. He went back to play. So the second impact syndrome, it's the 2 plus 2 equals 20. 2 plus 2 is not 4 anymore. So it's fairly, you know, exponential injury that can be devastating, can result in death. I mean, there was the quarterback from, I think, in Dallas, St. Mark's Episcopal, who had a second impact. And he was dead in 18 hours. So, I mean, it can be a fatal injury. And we don't know why it happens sometimes. There's some kind of blood vessel changes in the brain. It just swells up. And, you know, the mild injury wasn't that impressive clinically. And they didn't follow guidelines. They didn't take the player out of the field. And they said, no, I'm going to continue. So I think that's second impact syndrome. And it can be fatal.
Yeah, and I think, you know, animal studies have shown with forceful impacts that there is a biochemical change within the brain itself. It's not detectable on imaging, but there are changes in biochemical markers within the brain. And if that player is not allowed to rest and does sustain another head injury within that time frame while the brain is still technically recovering, those biochemical markers are still stabilizing, for whatever reason, it kind of sets off a severe chain of events where the child or player will suffer just severe cerebral swelling that, again, will result in coma and a lot of times death of that child.
Many retired players, as you mentioned, Dr. Barton, are second guessing whether or not football is a safe sport. And we have listeners out there tonight who may be grappling with the question, you know, I have a son, he's 5 or 6 years old, and he wants to play football. What should we recommend to these parents in terms of monitoring the children for how they tackle and how safe they're going to be with starting the game or any game that's going to be at high risk?
Yeah, so I think not just football. You touched on anything that you allow your children to participate in as a parent. You use your experience and kind of your past experiences and your judgment to determine whether you're going to allow your child to do that. I think what we have to do is get the parents educated so they can make a truly educated decision. Is this something I want my child to participate in? There are going to be parents out there who say, lacrosse, because it's so much impact, I don't ever want my child to play something like that. There are going to be other parents out there who say, wow, lacrosse is a great, game. It's going to get my kids involved in teamwork and sports and health. And so we've got to try to educate parents as best as we can to say, here are the real things to watch out for in these sports. Make sure your coaches of your kids' team are appropriately trained. And like we talked about, there are a lot of volunteer coaches. My son, he's had wonderful volunteer coaches here in Shreveport-Bossier. I know those people and I trust those people. You have to be involved. For those kids who don't have parents that can be involved, you know, particularly if it's a single parent household and they're working, that's where, as a medical community, we've got to try to make sure those coaches have the opportunity to be instructed in ways to help protect the kids.
Dr. Notoriani, I understand you work with some of these players and students after they've had a concussion, and I know there's a phenomenon known as the post-concussion syndrome, where a kid or even an adult can have persistent headaches more than 3 months after a concussion. Do you recommend anyone that has chronic headaches who has undergone a concussion that they seek medical attention for that?
Well, I do think that they should have some kind of evaluation if they're debilitating headaches and they is interfering with their daily life, and something like Tylenol or something isn't relieving that, then yes, they should probably seek attention from a medical professional. And those children that I have seen, luckily they are rare, but I have had a couple of children in my office, high school athletes that have had a head injury, a concussion, and have had a long duration of symptoms to the point that, you know, 2 months out they may still be having intermittent headaches. And the bottom line is I just don't even clear them to go back to play until they're symptom-free.
Absolutely. Dr. Barton, what is your approach to a player who still has a headache, let's say 1 or 2 weeks, you know, after a game or a nearly concussive event?
Well, I mean,
and those are the only symptoms, obviously. No other symptoms.
So if we look at post-concussive syndrome, the NCAA very nicely came out in around 2000. They were one of the first groups with their medical recommendation that if a player had any post-concussive syndromes, including continued headache, that they not be allowed to return to play. And that was, you know, that was 13 years ago. And so, but if you tell a player, if you still have a headache, I'm not going to be able to let you go back in. The next time you talk to them, be it 5 minutes later, they're no longer going to have a headache. Okay, mm-hmm. So we have to depend on these kids, these athletes, these adolescents, to be honest with us. But at the same time, we also have to understand, you know, what are we trying to do? We're trying to protect these kids from long-term injury, maybe that they don't appreciate. And if they still have a headache a week out, but they're starting to feel better, they're sleeping better, they're concentrating better, I don't recommend any big workup. If they have a headache that's debilitating, causing vision changes or starting to cause nausea, things like that that occur 3, 4, 5 days out and they're getting worse, then absolutely they need to be evaluated by a medical professional.
Yeah. And going to see their pediatrician or primary care physician would be the first.
Absolutely.
Be the first move. Dr. Anil Nanda, Professor and Chairman of Neurosurgery at LSU Health Sciences Center. Dr. Christina Notoriani, Chief of Pediatric Neurosurgery at LSU Health Sciences Center, and Dr. Shane Barton, Clinical Director of the Willis Knighton Sports Medicine Program. I thank you all for joining us tonight. Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all health questions, you should consult a physician or a health professional. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. Tonight's program was engineered by Kermit Poling, with production assistance from Wally Derleth, Henry Edwards, and Jeff Bryant. Support for this program comes from the Noel Foundation and also from the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. I'm Dr. Randy Brewer, and thank you for joining us this evening.